Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Seeking Sanctuary House to Heart, a podcast about abuse, trauma, and finding healing in the arms of Christ. As a warning, this podcast deals with difficult topics such as child abuse and intimate partner violence. So be gracious to yourself as you listen. And I'm one of your hosts, Nikki, from House of Faith and Freedom. You can check us out online at houseoffaithandfreedom.org, as well as on Facebook and Instagram. I'm here with my co-host and the founder of House of Faith and Freedom, Hannah.
As Nikki said, I'm Hannah, and I'm really excited to introduce today's guest, author, advocate, entrepreneur, and the founder of a really incredible nonprofit called Doves Network, Tiffany Mensa. I originally connected with Tiffany through reading her memoir, Forgotten, and was inspired by her story of grit and faith in the midst of childhood domestic violence.
Because I saw my parents fight, I thought this was love. Like, love isn't love unless there's arguing and fighting like this, and it's not. Mm-hmm. And so the more we talk about it in our churches, in our youth groups, we have such an opportunity to raise the standard because sin thrives in the darkness.
Tiffany, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me to have the conversation.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons that we actually started this podcast was to be able to have space to bring forward the stories of survivors, because often it's in these personal testimonies that other victims and survivors are able to find understanding and language for their own experiences. So with that said, I'd love to just jump right in to hearing a little bit more about your own personal story.
Yeah, so my story started really at 7 years old, watching my father abuse my mother. And the type of family that I was raised in was like, what happens here stays here. You can't talk about what's happening. You're just put on a face. So, you know, if mom is abused too much where she can't go to church, you know, she doesn't feel good. That's the story you're sticking to. What made that even more complex was that my father is a preacher. And when you're sitting front row to that, you don't understand how God can be a part of this. I remember plenty of times my mother calling even my grandmother and asking for assistance. And she would just be a better wife. I remember her going to the church and asking other ministers for help. And they would say, you know, God hates a divorce and you have to endure this. Right. And so for me, there was no safe haven in church. It was, okay, God must condone this. At the age of 9, because the abuse was getting worse, my mother fled. And at that time, agencies and shelters weren't high on the radar to go to. So you went to friends of family or family members for safety. And it was during those mad dashes of asylum where I was being re-traumatized by those we were staying with. And so when we're on these mad dashes of asylum, I'm with these other families, but I've been automatically conditioned to don't talk, don't feel, don't trust. So I'm not opening up, but they saw that as you're evil, you're a spoiled brat. And so I started internalizing that. I remember even as a kiddo, we were at church with the guests we were living with, and I'd never been in youth ministry before because I grew up in a Baptist church. So there wasn't a youth ministry. You're right there with the adults. And because I didn't want to be in youth ministry because I'm separated from my mother, the only safe human I know, the women laid hands on me and prayed and said that you have a demon. We're going to pray it out of you. You're evil. So that was foundational for me, which propelled me into my adolescent years where I was very angry, very combative, feeling very forgotten, very unheard. And that led to me self-medicating in the streets from what culture was telling me to do, which led to ridiculous, horrible relationships, relationship patterns. And once I got to college, my mother finally got away and broke free and divorced after 30 years. It was very combative. Now she's re-traumatized through the court system. And so again, my anger just continued to get more and more compounded, where then I became a caregiver for her. So I'm a freshman in college, and now I'm taking care of my mother And again, you're still more angry, but now you're like, I'm never going to be like how my mom was. And so we know abuse is rooted in power and control. Now I'm manipulating relationships to be the way that I feel like I can protect myself to not be like my mother, not knowing that I'm basically becoming my father. But then the relationships that I was also in became abusive themselves. But I felt like I'm literally fist fighting them back. So I'm not being my mom, but it's still the cycle of dysfunction that came through that household until I got into corporate America straight out of college. And I tried walking back down this road of going back to church because there were so many different angels along the way that I know we'll talk about. But I had trouble with men in authority, even at church. And at that time, I was having other fallouts, not just in romantic relationships, but friendships. And when you keep hitting walls and keep hitting barriers, you have to look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself the truth. Like, I think it's me. And it was me. And that started my whole healing journey and being able to trace back that it all stemmed from sitting in that living room, seeing my father abuse my mother time after time, that I started internalizing these normalized dysfunctions. And this is how that impact played out. Based on that, you know, walked down that healing, ended up getting married further down the line. And I call my husband my purpose partner because he's who pushed this vision out. Like my book, my memoir started as my senior paper in college. It was just so therapeutic. I kept writing, but it was very angry. But he encouraged me to pick it up from a place of healing and wholeness. And that is how my book, Forgotten, was published. But I didn't want to just draw awareness. I wanted to draw action. And that's where the birth of my nonprofit came from, of Daily Overcoming Violence and Embracing Safety. Because my mom got on the front lines of domestic violence advocacy like a couple years after the divorce. And she mentioned, you should go back and heal the teens, you know. And I was like, no, that's your thing. But after I got healed and writing, I kept hearing the news. There's so many women, there's so many even men too that are rising that are not making it out alive. But I don't hear mention about the kids. Like, what about the teens? What about the kids healing? Their kids watching their parents being killed right in front of them. What's out there for them? And I felt like God kept inclining my ear to this. And that is where I saw my place to take up the mantle and start Doves Network. And so that is my story of I went through it. It was such a compounded impact in various areas, but I healed through it. And through healing, I'm going back and making sure that I uproot these seeds of dysfunction and intergenerational trauma.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. I'm thinking of the words you said towards the beginning of your story, mm-hmm. when you said, don't talk, don't feel, don't trust. Mm-hmm. And you felt like people assumed you were just an angry brat or whatever as a young kid.
Yeah.
What would have helped you at that age? And maybe even tying into what are some of the things that Dove provides?
Yeah. What would have helped was someone really just talking to me. Hey, how are you feeling? How are you feeling about all of this? And just being real, like, I know this is a lot of change that's happening. How are you processing? Like, there was never a conversation. Never a conversation. It was like, we're moving place to place. This is where it is. Like, don't tell where you're at. Don't talk. They'll tell the story. You could be taken from me. But those who are supposed to be the safe havens, you have that pass to be able to say, what can I do? Even if you don't want to talk about it, let's color together. I was 9 years old, 10 years old. I was literally on the run from 9 through 14 and then 16. So those foundational developmental years of even my brain and emotions, just do something with me. Let's go to the park. What do you like to do? What is that interest that you have? And it wasn't until I met someone when he's still my lifelong mentor. His name's Greg Hardin. And I was 9. And he was like, you're very angry. And I was like, I don't like you. But every time I saw him, he said, you're going to be the one that sees outside the box. He always spoke just a sentence, even though how hard I was, he spoke a sentence of life. And as
I became a teenager, we talked more about my feelings. He would put those seeds of hope of like, you can't go into the world this angry, and would help me process and take me to seminars. And he knew I had a gift in writing. So he would, hey, you should do summer camps for journalism. So like someone actually intentionally seeing me and not looking at my behaviors and just dismissing me to be able to say, I feel like this. But again, because you have these formative years, you don't know what you feel. So we have peer groups for teenagers. And one of the things that I give them is a feeling wheel right off the bat. Like from the time you come in, you get a kit that says you are not forgotten. And within here, we talk about the importance of this feelings wheel, because I'm sure you all are familiar with this, but it's like from the center, here's just basic feelings, but let's put more language to what it is and drill a little bit deeper. No one was able to help me articulate what it was I'm feeling. I just know I'm feeling this, but my language hasn't developed yet because I'm such a young age. Now, when I get older, the rap songs I'm listening to are helping formulate exactly how I feel, which also fuels the rage that I have, which also isn't helpful. So hope that answers your question. I know that was a long-winded answer.
No, and I think too, like you said, language is so important because it helps us comprehend what it is that we're experiencing, whether that's in like our trauma healing, whether that's understanding the emotions we're experiencing, or putting language to what abuse is, especially when we're talking about some of these emotional and psychological forms of abuse that can be hard to pin down.
Yeah.
And that's part of like why we have to talk to our kids about it. I just feel like kids are really perceptive and they pick up a lot more on things than we give them credit for. And so, especially in relationships where there might be abuse going on between the parents, but they think that their kids are oblivious, they're not. They're not. They hear it. They pick up on these subtle signs. And I think it's better to start addressing these conversations, these challenging topics with your kids, and find a way to safely talk with them about it. Or give them someone else who is a safe adult that can talk to them, than to sort of just ignore it and hope that they aren't perceiving it.
Yeah. And that was one of the hard conversations my mom and I had to have. I never knew how to just tell her that. And so when she read my book, that was the first time she knew all that was happening with me, you know, truth moments. And she's like, I was just trying to survive. And I was like, that's exactly why I'm doing this, is not to bring any like condemnation or any shame upon the surviving parent. It is to bring that awareness that, hey, because you are so focused on surviving, let us come into and link arms with you to help you with your teen, how to help you peaceful parent, how to help you be able to serve their needs. Because I watched my mother literally trying to survive. I watched my mother fighting through depression. I watched my mother do the best that she can and give all that she could, but yet be unavailable to me. I know that if we were having conversations like being had in the early 90s, she would have definitely parented from a different place. And it's not that you desire or she desired to do what she did. She just didn't know. And so now we are in such a time where being able to prioritize that is here. We have so many more resources that are rooted in social emotional learning to help, because a lot of the things that you see in our teens today, in our kiddos, it is a impact of the environment. Some of the teens that I work with, they're either directly in the environment, which is how they're being exposed to the trauma. They're also being abused with the parent, and or you add all those. And then there's also a sexual abuse component as well. And you're definitely going to have your individual healing paths, but there's impact and power of togetherness in healing. That's where the intergenerational brings up. That's where you're able to walk this down together. And it's okay to be transparent with your teen, your kiddo. It's okay to be vulnerable with them, because that also helps raise their protectiveness up of like, they're not going into the world shielded from it. Because the thing that I kept hearing was pray it away. Mm-hmm. Prayer works, but there's also action that comes with that. What does that action look like? And that's where agencies like myself
come in to be able to help that.
And I love how you said, you know, there's no condemnation on the survivor. She was just trying to make it. And yeah. I will say, what I hear in the people that we come across in terms of survivors is, what is out there for my kids? How do I handle this? Do I talk about the abuse with them? Do I not? How do I come alongside of them? You know, I'm just a little overwhelmed. Oh my goodness. You know, I'm guessing our listeners have, you know, 25 questions right now. So yeah. Anna, can you help me with a good question? I mean, which one should I choose?
Oh boy, I have a lot of directions I could go. One of the ones that I'm sort of thinking about, and I'm curious, Tiffany, if this is something that you've tied into Dove's Network also, is how writing was so instrumental in your healing process, sort of finding this way to go back and piece together your experiences and really dig into them from this place of healing and having that language to understand. There's this book called What Happened to You by Dr. Bruce Perry, and actually Oprah was the co-author, and I want to read this quote from it. It says, "Trauma leaves you shipwrecked. You're left to rebuild your inner world. And part of that rebuilding, part of the healing process, is revisiting the shattered hull of your old world. You sift through the wreckage, looking for what remains, seeking your broken pieces. As you revisit the shipwreck piece by piece, you find a fragment and move it to your new, safer place in the now altered landscape. You build a new worldview, and that takes time. That takes many visits to the wreckage. And this process involves both unconscious and conscious repetitive reenactment behaviors of writing, drawing, sculpting, or playing again and again. You revisit the site of the earthquake, look through the wreckage, take something, and move it to a safe haven. That's part of the healing process." So I'm curious, in your experience through writing, if there were any other types of healing activities that you found were useful for you, and maybe any ways that you've incorporated that same kind of concept or idea into helping the teens and youth today with Dove's Network as they sift through and sort through their trauma and some of the wreckage that comes out of being part of a family where there was abuse taking place.
Yeah, great, great question. And that was one of my resources I was going to provide, The Body Keeps Score. That book is amazing. With healing, there is that repetitive aspect. So because like one of the stats that's tied to this is like, children exposed to domestic violence has the same PTSD that accompanies a soldier returning from war. So you're always being re-triggered, whether that's through sight, whether that's through sound. You're in a constant state of hypervigilance as well, and having to recenter yourself. So as I'm listening to that, where you keep going back, like just letting the listeners know, there's those triggers that will make you go back, that you have to be equipped to be able to have those recentering techniques for, to let your body know I'm safe. Those components of healing that's rooted in the core protective systems. And so resilience is supported when our kiddos have those relationships that are competent, that are supportive, that are positive. So that is one layer that is offered through the peer support groups. We call them peace groups. Because when you also think about Doves, though we have the acronym of Daily Overcoming Violence, Embrace, and Safety, Doves, a bird, it represents peace. So a lot of our anchoring is within peace, peace within yourself, and peace when you're in these groups. So that core protective is right there. We're having a tribe. Your child can come and be safe on this virtual Zoom to just be. Within there is the capabilities of being able to teach them that emotional regulation. So we have tools like the feelings well. We have games that are centered around social emotional learning, so that like our kids don't want to feel like they're still in school. So we take a lot of these books and we put a game to it to be able to have them level in on that emotional regulation, give them mindfulness tips, being able to have a positive view of self. Because a lot of times when you are a child growing up in a home, even if it's not talked about, you feel guilt. You feel a sense of responsibility, like, well, maybe it was my fault. I can't do anything. So teaching them and coaching them through that phase, we're their peace advocates. That is the name of the peer leaders and myself. It's like, you're your peace coach, your peace advocate, so that no matter what you're triggered by, you have these. Then you have different activities where you're able to just talk through what are your passions. Because again, for me, I wasn't really a talker, but when you talk about writing, I can write my feelings all day. So let me get a journal to help write those things out. We are launching actually this summer different interest groups where you just want to write. We're going to have some writing classes to help structure that creative writing, right? If there are creative arts, we have some instructors throughout my network that are able to do different crafts, because healing looks different for the child. And so being able to develop those different aspects where they're able to learn different breathing activities, like knowing the importance of just breathing and pausing. In Psalms a lot, there's like those Selah moments. So when you look at with that breathing, it's like, take a 2-minute Selah and just pause. And that's rewriting a lot of the brain activity and firing off positive neurons, right? Or getting on some swings, going to a park with your teen or kid, and being able to spend that one-on-one time that develops those, like you said, those pattern, rhythmic, repetitive movements, because it's a regulatory activity. So when your child is in your womb, it's those experiences in the wombs that involves the rhythmic sound of even your mother's heartbeat, where the fluid and the movement rocks us. That's why those repetitive and repertory aspects are important to the healing process. Dancing, singing, what is on your playlist, right? Being able to come into their world and understanding that our kids' healing is not going to look like what yours is, but it does involve an immersion into their world. And it involves a lot more listening and not pushing down their feelings. Like even my mom mentioned a couple times when I was younger, like, you're just so angry. You're just so evil too. My mom said it, and she cringes like, oh, I didn't know. Because a lot of times, depending on the generations and how we're brought up, the child's voice didn't have a voice. And so what do you mean you feel stressed? What do you mean you feel depressed? Like, go in your room and like do something. You have no reason. But the science is showing that this is the reason why we need to uproot that now, because our teens, our kids, they do feel this and they do have that impact.
Yeah, for sure. Body Keeps the Score and What Happened to You are two really excellent resources that talk about some of those healing elements on a more scientific level around rhythmic movement, community, some new therapeutic approaches that are really interesting and groundbreaking in our understanding of trauma. Something that you said that really stuck with me, Tiffany, is that it's not only our ways of expressing ourselves, things like art and dance or sports, these things that for the brain are literally helpful in its healing process through community and rhythmic movement, but these extracurriculars are also like a side door for us to begin to build those safe relationships with kids that are emotionally shut down. Like, they don't have, like you mentioned in your own story, they don't have a history of being heard if they're part of a dysfunctional family where there was abuse happening. And so there's not going to be like this instantaneous trust in most situations or relationships. That's something that you're going to have to build up and develop by consistently showing up, by consistently immersing yourself in their world in ways that feel safe to them. And so I think, what a cool opportunity to go through some of these side doors of their interests and just say, yeah, I'm going to show up and engage with you on this thing that you care about, and then leave that door open for whenever you might need to process something more than that. I want to take a step back here for a second and talk through some of, you actually alluded to this earlier, when you were talking, but some of these angels that you encountered in your growing up years and your teen years that redirected you back towards God and who helped to be the agents of God's provision and protection.
Yeah. A lot of times in my former pastor, when I was in Michigan, had mentioned you view God based on the relationship that you view your earthly parent. So if you're scared of your earthly parent, or like the father figure is like dominant or abusive, you fear God being that same way. And a lot of, especially because my father was a preacher, you got a lot of God's going to strike you down, or you got a lot of, I'm going to pray to God strike you down because you did this, right? So there was a lot of like, I feared God. Like there wasn't a healthy picture of God. Like I didn't see God as loving. I saw him as, you're just like my dad. Ugh. So I knew I didn't want anything to do with the church. When I got to college, I was still scared of God. So I'm going to still pray over my food on Sundays. I'm going to still listen to church. But then at 6 o'clock, I'm going to turn on like my playlist that I normally will listen to. If I go to the club on Saturday, I'm going to make sure I go to church because I was scared of God. But what started happening was that the song, The Reckless Love of God, I felt like that was me. It was these opportunities that just kept opening up that it was no other, it was God all the way. Like I wouldn't have money for books. And all of a sudden, this lady I'm working with is like, me and my husband are going to pay for your books. I don't know you. Okay, thank you. I'm getting jobs. I'm in college, no degree, and I'm working for University of Michigan Hospital in a discharge planning department, and I have favor with all the nurses, and I'm going to see patients. Nursing, medical was not even in my like studies in college. No one but God. I'm getting paid over the average of minimum wage, right? I get into another hospital, same thing. I'm getting into working for county government. I haven't even graduated college yet. So it's like, I knew it was God. I'm meeting people who are giving me different approaches to how I've viewed God, how I view church, of like, no, that's not the right position to see God in. That's not the right lens. Again, the pastor I mentioned, Pastor Chris Brooks, he was the pastor at the church my mom was going to. And again, I was like, I'm okay. But he kept drawing me in. It was like, leave the 99 for the one. And he kept, how are you? How is this? Tell me what you're thinking. And I was one that I felt like I didn't have anything to lose. And I would just say, I don't trust you. I don't trust the church. And here's the reason why. He was the first person to sit down and spend time with me to say, I'm sorry you experienced that. I'm sorry your family went through that. But the humanity of man isn't the divinity of God. And you have to know God for yourself. And he was patient to teach me how to have a relationship with God. He was able to teach me the right way to view the Bible, having that right theological view of the word, and also teaching that, yes, people who do not have a correct theological view will mistreat the word. And the fact that he made space for me, for my family, but most importantly, he stood up in a pulpit and talked about abuse. That spoke volumes to me. And that was like, all right, okay. I want to learn more about this version of God that I've never been experienced. And once I walk down that road, I've never turned back from it, because I've experienced God for myself and my own experiences to see him in this new lens, mm-hmm. even so much to the point of the radical forgiveness of even my father. And that's, I think that's another area that's not talked about a lot with kids, is that we love both of our parents. We love our mother and we love our father. Whoever the offender is, we're in a state of cognitive dissonance because we know what they're doing wrong, but also we love them. And we feel like we may get penalized if we show that love, or we still want to be around them. And we don't know how to navigate between those two worlds. And so there's grace that should be applied to them, but also an acknowledgement of watch outs, because yes, that offending parent can use that to manipulate, but the child shouldn't be punished for how they feel about their parent. And a lot of times I was in that middle role. Now I'm an adult and I can handle that. But as a child, that hurts my development. That hurts my heart of like, I gotta choose. And so with me learning God and learning who he is at core, that he's a loving God, he's a forgiving God, he's a just God, all of that. And yes, there is the scary Old Testament verse with that, that ultimately God is for me. He's not against me. He will use this. He doesn't condone this. And I was able to have a lens of empathy where I was able to radically forgive my father in my adulthood years. Like once I got my healing, because also like with being trauma informed, you look back like what happened? Like what's wrong with you? What happened? And I was able to track back. My grandfather abused my grandmother. Like my grandmother was also like abusive too. Like when you talk about the generational sins will follow, you start peeling this onion back and you start seeing the layers of abuse. He parented and he husbanded from a place that he thought was normal. And two things can be true. I can love you and I can still bring awareness that what you did was wrong. And we had those tough conversations. He was not happy that my book came out. He was, because again, what happens here stays here. And he was still a preacher at the time. But for that time that we didn't talk and he listened to even a lot of my interviews, He came to the awareness that your kids are paying attention even when you don't think they're paying attention. He started self-correcting in a lot of ways, that when he took his last breath on November 12, 2021, he texted my mother how sorry he was, that he texted us and like he loved us and that wasn't his intention. Like there was that and like, God, I love my dad. We're back in a good place, but I got to push this purpose out. How does that work? I'm going to trust you. Like, I got to take up my cross and I'm going to trust you. He brought that back 6 months before my father passed. So again, a lot of times we come, and I'm not saying it's not warranted, but as children of God, we still have to forgive the offenders as well in that story. Not for them, but for us. And for me, I showed him, Daddy, I still love you. I still walked down 1 Corinthians 13 and how that applied to us. And I kept loving on him. I would send him letters, even when we weren't talking, to say there's no condemnation. Like I'm now, like I know you're a preacher and I know you feel like I'm pointing my finger at you. But no, I love you. I'm showing you God's love. And that love restored us. And that carried and gave me that peace and the reconciliation that he put on my mom and put on me even before. Because I saw him a week before he had a heart attack and died. I saw him a week before, and it was like he walked down everything of his life. It was like God orchestrated that. So I think I got off on a little bit of a tangent there. But I wanted to bring that full circle of that. That's how I experience God, and even experiencing him in an adult, that he would bring things full circle and reconciliation even before he turned and took his last breath.
I feel like everything you just described, it's love and truth, right? It's like we don't bury it. We don't live in this place where we're like, oh, we don't talk about those parts of our life or our history or our actions. There can be accountability and grace that coexist. And I think we have this tendency to want to pick in the church. Like, we want to be people who just love the God of mercy or people who only love the God of justice. And we have to find a way to balance those two things. And part of that is being truthful, calling out that, you know, abuse is a behavior that's not acceptable. Those patterns are sinful and they do pass down generationally and they're not okay. And we should condemn them from the pulpit and we should talk about it. And it's good to talk about our experiences and our stories and acknowledge that those things did happen to us. And at the same time, like you said, it can open a door for that process of forgiveness, for that process of love in spite of the injustices or the pain that we've suffered.
Correct. And when you talk about the intergenerational aspect as well, that's why it's also so important to talk to them, is right now in February, we're in Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, where 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 10 boys have experienced physical or sexual dating violence, which equates to 1 in 3 adolescents. Overall, it's 1.5 million teens. So when you think about, like, our teens are in this right now, how are they being impacted? Because what's happening at home now just plays out within that life cycle. So the earlier you can talk to them and normalize the abnormal, like, activity of this, like, this isn't normal. Love doesn't hurt. I've had 16-year-old girls say, I didn't know that this was abuse because I saw my parents fight. I thought this was love. Like, love isn't love unless there's arguing and fighting like this. And it's not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the more we talk about it in our churches, in our youth groups, we have such an opportunity to raise the standard, because sin thrives in the darkness. And unless we shine this light, that was Jesus' whole mission, was to be like, hey, I know y'all doing it this way, but there's some blind spots over here you have to address. You have to address this, because lives are at this. Exactly to your point, abuse is sin. And a lot of times when it comes to, like, the church being aware, we can't just turn a blind eye to this because it's uncomfortable. I literally had a church say to me, I don't want my church being known as a domestic violence shelter. Like, the driving awareness does not constitute that at all. What it does is it shows your stance in the gospel of care. And the gospel that this is why Jesus came, was for the oppressed, was to set free. And even if you don't know the times that we're in right now, you have to know. Yes. And you have to be able to ensure your staff is trained. And you have to be able to make sure your staff are safe and not re-traumatizing your congregants when they come. And you have to prioritize the safety of them, whether that's not saying you have to learn all these things, but you should at least know the signs. You should at least know that marriage counseling isn't the solution, because the victim won't be able to share freely what's happening without repercussions on the back end later. You should at least know the agencies in your radius that's on the front lines that can partner with you to be able to prioritize that congregant safety. Because, oh, by the way, should something happen at your church, God forbid, you're going to be held liable. Like, I hate to bring it that realistic, but ultimately, if you don't address these, it's going to show up on your front door one way or the other. So the best way is the prevention way, so that we can cut it out and uproot it. And if someone is in it, they know I can go to this church because they're safe and they've already put their stance. And that's what the gospel wants the church position to be, is that those who can come in, they're finding safety, and that they're seeing the hands of God, and that the hands of God are not pushing them back into this marriage or this relationship for the sake of image and stats and tithes.
Huh.
Yes. Preach. Yes. Yes. Keep going. I agree with all of that. I mean, this is literally why House of Faith and Freedom exists. Because what is that base degree of training and of knowledge that we need to have as a church? Because ultimately, God is love, right? 1 John says God is love. And so when we think about abuse, it's the opposite of it. Like, if you look at 1 Corinthians 13 and that list of behaviors that describe love, and you just do the inverse of that, you have abusive behaviors. There it is, right? We have to care, because abuse is an affront against God. And if we as churches really want to say that we're loving people the way God loves them, we have to care about abuse. If we want to say that we're prioritizing healthy marriages and covenant relationships, we have to care about abuse, because it's this horrible warping of that covenant. If we want to continue to be a place that's a champion of freedom in the gospel, we have to care about the oppressed. Like, these are not optional things. And to your point, you don't have to start a full-time ministry around domestic violence. Like, I realize that churches have to care about a lot of different issues. And it should be a relief to you that there are organizations locally that do specialize in abuse and you can refer to them. It's like, have enough knowledge that you don't cause more damage when someone walks through your doors and that you can wisely refer them, and then build those partnerships up with those community agencies, because that's also showing them that you're a church that's safe, that you champion victims and survivors. And that just goes back to talking about youth groups too. That's a big one, because back in my era, I mean, our youth ministries, like, the only thing we would talk about as far as relationships, and I can't testify to if this is how it still is, but back then, was basically don't have sex. That was it, period. There were no other conversations. And we really need to start doing a better job talking about what is healthy, what is good communication, what is respect, what is consent, what does godly love look like? We need to really dive into those topics with youth so that more than just trying to be a checkpoint for people who are carrying some form of generational trauma, we can maybe be the people who prevent it from starting in the first place by helping these teens before they get caught in a relationship or in a covenant marriage with someone who's really going to perpetuate these types of sinful behaviors in their own life.
Yeah, because even with that, I'm so glad you called that out. It's because the sooner you can see it, you don't even have to walk down that path, because so many stories are not the happily testimony that my mom has, that she was able to get free. And they're starting younger and younger, where you're hearing it, which is such a tragedy, which is the reason why there's such an urgency on this.
And I love that you had a pastor that it began with him understanding you and knowing you. And so therefore he gained an understanding, yeah, and that brought about validation, and that being so essential in recovery, yeah, validation. And then, like you said, he had the patience to teach you. And then even further, he talked about it from the pulpit. I mean, I can't think of a better flow in the process of walking alongside of someone in abuse. Understanding, validation, having the patience to teach, and then speaking it from the pulpit.
Yeah.
What an amazing flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, only God would bring that person in your life at the right time.
Yes.
I think to just sort of wrap around this conversation, you already touched on a decent amount of this, Tiffany, but if you could tell the church, like in a handful of bullet points, the things that they should know about abuse, and then any additional resources that you would direct either people who've experienced this in their families growing up, who are experiencing it presently in their current intimate partner relationships, or who have survived it and made it out, or those who maybe have family members or friends who are going through this right now, and they're just trying to figure out how to understand and support and bring the right language into the situation. So any resources and wisdom for the church, and resources and wisdom for those walking this path right now?
Yeah, that's a lot. I'm a spitfire. So starting with the church. Like, number one, prioritize safety, and believe survivors, because it takes a lot of courage to be able to say, this is what I'm experiencing, this is what my family experiencing. It's very courageous. And what I would say with that is, like, if you're like, hey, we're going to talk it out, or we put them together, and I touched on this a little bit, it's think about you're sitting in a room. And there is, and I heard this analogy, I was like, this is the perfect analogy. And there's a piano hanging over your head. And you don't know what's going to make that piano drop on your head. That is what it's like for a victim to be next to their abuser. And when these sessions may happen of like mediation, and because they may not talk or share, then seems like everything's fine. Everything's been addressed. And then from the moment they get back in the car, they're dealing with all of the backlash from the time they said something. if there is a visual of what that looks like and why the traditional escalation process has been, that's the one. So prioritize safety. Understand what the victim needs for themselves or their family and work to get them in a place of safety. Because at the end of the day as well, oh, by the way, domestic violence is a crime. It's a whole crime. Sexual assault is a crime. And you have a responsibility to make sure that as the shepherd, these congregants who are in your care, they're safe. So prioritizing and believing, not prescribing or telling them what needs to be done, because again, abuse is rooted in power and control. So therefore, if they tell you and then you start random, like spit firing all the things they need to do, their voice has already been muted. They don't have a lot of control. So again, they're taking a huge step by talking to you, and you listening and asking how they can be supported is empowering. It develops trust. Safety and trust has to be the foundation before you get anywhere else. They have to know that you care before your information, before your stats, before your numbers. You got to level with them. Well, what do they need to empower their voice and to empower the collaboration, be able to get them the safety? So I would say, again, knowing the signs, because like a lot of times we look at, well, I don't see any physical, emotional, and financial are the most highest cases because they're invisible. You really don't see those at surface. So being able to have trauma-informed counselors, resources that's available a lot of times, like, oh, we can take you through our, you know, we have Bible counselors. That is great. Everything we do should be partnered through the lens of Christ. But you also need some trauma-informed certified support, because that's a different level of science that goes into the mind. And sometimes I don't know how to take that scripture if mentally I'm still replaying this. So the trauma-informedness will help the practical. And then you put the supernatural on there with the word of God in prayer. That's going to help water those seeds further. So being able to have those resources available, being able to have those agencies that are in the community that can partner with you. You don't have to do the workshop. You can just invite them in for a Saturday or a special tabling at your church. Like, there's resources and creative ways that you're able to infuse this into what it is that you do. Same thing for the teens. Same thing. And again, I know, like, the word of God is our source. We are not saying replace that, remove that out, but our teens are going to do it whether they're told to or not. I was that teen. Again, born in the word, in the church. I was told not to. I still did it, because what you're not talking to me about, what you're not talking to them about, they're going to learn and get it from the culture, from social media, from Facebook, from the TikToks. That is the source of information right now. So you want to be able to have those conversations with them to be able to help safely treat like what it is they're feeling, and they get ahead of it. The other thing is making sure that your doctrine and the theology you preach is also having scriptural support behind it in the right lens. Because the word, the Bible, is weaponized so much. And I know I'm getting a little bit over time. But also the Body Keep Score with some great resources as well. Healing is ongoing. And again, for me, as I went through healing, I was in counseling and in church. So my counselor was amazing with that, getting some peer groups. We have peer groups for the teens. Later on in the year, we're going to be launching for college students and also starting to roll out parenting, healing, peaceful parenting as well. And I also have a book called Relational Intelligence by Dr. Darius Daniels. That's amazing, because even coming out of healing, what relationships do you trust? And also learning about adverses. There's a YouTube video of Dr. Nadine Burke Harris that talks about the adverse childhood experiences. And I'll also send that link over. There's a couple other books of like When Dad Hurts Mom, and that's Helping Your Children Heal the Wounds of Witnessing Abuse, along with Why Does He Do That by Lundy Bancroft. And Lundy Bancroft is the author of both of those books.
Mm-hmm. And I will link all of those resources in the show notes so that you have easy access to them, as well as links to Dove's Network and Tiffany's book, Forgotten. And I just want to say thank you, Tiffany, because so many of the things that you said and you brought up in this podcast have been echoed through the voices of the survivors that we've had on the show, and have also been echoed through some of the great advocacy agencies that we work with. There is such an important role that the church has to play in helping people heal from trauma and abuse, but that can really only happen when we have a trauma-informed perspective. And when we understand the dynamics of abuse. And I think that, like you mentioned, there are certain things that can make us more susceptible to re-traumatizing people. All of that said, do you have any last thoughts before we sign off here?
No, I'm so grateful for you and Nikki, like, shining the light on this, and that, you know, we're continually staying connected to raise this light and to drive the awareness to impact change, to impact the outcome, right? So I'm just grateful that you invited me on to be able to share, you know, we are free by the testimonies, right? And even with the trauma-informed approach, it's so important, because sometimes people feel like it's just me going through this, and having platforms like this to share light shows that it's not just you. It's not just a one-off, and there's healing, and healing and wholeness is possible. And that even though it may seem as though it's not working for your good, know that, again, before you and your mother's womb, there's a plan. This was not a part of the plan, but God is going to repurpose it into something beautiful, and making sure you're connected with those who want to see you win, who are your peace advocates. You know, we're out here for you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Tiffany, and for sharing your experiences and the incredible work that you're doing with Dove's Network. You've been listening to Speaking Sanctuary House to Heart. This podcast is a production of House of Faith and Freedom with your hosts, Hannah and Nikki. For more information about intimate partner violence training for the church, you can check out our website, houseoffaithandfreedom.org.